This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. When Lev Grossman read the Harry Potter series, he wondered if he could write something like that for adults. Started writing The Magicians in 2004. Like Harry Potter, it's about a young guy who stumbles across a secret world of magic. The main character, Quentin, even gets to attend a magic academy, much like Hogwarts. But there is where the similarities end. Instead of fighting evil, Quentin and his gang experiment with sex, drugs, and alcohol. Instead of grand quests, these young wizards tackle existential angst. The Magicians became a New York Times bestseller in 2009. Its sequel, The Magician King, has just been released. Quentin's now ruling the magical world called Fillory. He's been discovered, he has discovered, that being king adds pounds to his paunch, but not much excitement to its life. And when Lev Grossman is not writing novels, he is Time Magazine's book critic. He's going to read from his work and sign copies at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight. But first, we have him in the studio. Lev Grossman, welcome.
Thank you.
How did the idea for this series come about?
Well, you know, novels come out of sort of usually a whole sort of cluster of aha moments. But I think, you know, the real one was just I was 35 and thinking about what sort of a book I would like to write next. And I found myself, I asked myself, what was the most intense, compelling reading experience that I ever had? And if I was being honest, the answer was probably when I was 8 years old, reading The Chronicles of Narnia. And I thought about whether it would be possible to write a story like that, about, you know, young people discovering they have power that they didn't know they had and finding their way into a secret world. But write it for adults and put in all the stuff that writers like Lewis and Rowling, who write for young adults, airbrush out all the difficulties of adult life, the complications, the challenges, the confusion. And out of that came The Magicians and then The Magician King.
And that was going to be the book you're describing to yourself is, of course, fantasy. Did it strike you at the time when this occurred to you as a very good idea that maybe fantasy wasn't the kind of book a book critic should be writing?
Well, there was some plucking up of courage that that had to take place. I had to, in some sense, come out to myself as a fantasy writer. There's a gut check moment every for the first time anybody writes a sentence when they're described where they describe somebody casting a magic spell. But, you know, once that had happened, the words just flowed out in a way that they never had before. I really realized that I had been somehow, in some sense, writing in what was a foreign language to me my whole life. And writing fantasy was like writing my mother tongue for the first time. And I, you know, and I also became aware that there were other writers doing the same thing, that it wasn't at all outlandish to be doing this, writers like Susanna Clarke, Neil Gaiman, Kelly Link, China Mieville. You know, there's a whole, you wouldn't call it a movement, but right, there's a sort of school of writers who are doing stuff like this. And when I read their stuff, it was just so tremendously exciting. I realized what I wanted to do.
And you recently wrote a piece that appeared in the Wall Street Journal that said, look, it's about time we start taking this writing seriously and not distinguish it from literary writing.
Well, you know, just to take the example of Shakespeare, since it's in the air, you know, there was through most of the lifetime of human literature, most literature was fantasy. Having witches or ghosts or spirits or magicians in your work was no barrier to it being taken seriously. It didn't disqualify it for meaning and saying the serious things that literature is supposed to say. And I think we're actually rediscovering that.
So in your series now, in your first book, you actually put in these characters in a world where there were no real clear-cut monsters to fight. I mean, was that a deliberate decision?
It was a deliberate decision. It was one of the things that I felt, not a decision so much as something I felt I needed to do. You know, when I was, it's a convention of the fantasy genre to have a figure in your book who is the incarnation of ultimate evil, someone like Sauron or the White Witch or Voldemort. And that person acts as a kind of moral compass for everybody. Everybody knows whether they're good or evil. because they know whether they're on the whether they're fighting that guy or serving him. I wanted to ask, well, what happens if you remove that figure from the story? What kind of a story do you get? And as it turns out, you get a very different kind of story, much less about using magic to defeat evil and much more about trying to figure out what magic is for.
Hmm. And so where the interior lives of the characters become much more important to us.
Well, there's many more shades of gray, and this question of motivation becomes much more complicated. The characters are struggling to do good, but they really don't know what good is. They recognize that they have both good and evil impulses in them, but they don't always know which ones they're following at any given moment.
At the end of The Magicians, your first book in the series, Quentin and his friends make it to this place called Fillory, modeled on the land of Narnia from C.S. Lewis novels. There he finally finds evil and defeats it, but in the process loses the woman he loves. Now, where does the Magician King pick up?
The Magician King, it begins a couple of years after the end of The Magicians. Quentin, the hero, and his friends have become the kings and queens of Fillory, much as the Pevensies do at the end of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Lewis, of course, skates fairly rapidly over the over that period in the Pevensies' lives. But I wanted to stop and look at what it would actually be like to be the ruler of a kind of secret magical utopia. And what I thought was, it would be absolutely marvelous for maybe a couple of years. But after that time had passed, one would get a bit restless. One would wonder whether this sort of unrelenting peace and luxury was really enough. And one would start looking around for an adventure. And that's what Quentin is doing at the beginning of The Magician King.
Will you read for us?
Yes, of course. A few yards away, a round clearing began, a still pool of grass hidden in the heart of the forest. The trees grew right up to its edge and then stopped, like somebody had cleared it on purpose, nipping out the border precisely. It could have been ruled with a compass. In the center of the clearing stood a single enormous oak tree with a large round clock set in its trunk. Whatever it was a Fillorian wonder, a real one, wild and grand and strange. It was a long time since Quentin had seen one. Or maybe it was just a long time since he'd noticed.
Lev Grossman reading from his new book, The Magician King. He's going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight doing a book signing and Q&A. But now we are lucky enough to have him in the studio today talking about the new book. When you create the world Fillory, does it happen kind of a step at a time or does it reveal itself to you all at once?
Well, you know, I'm not one of these Tolkien-type world builders. He's really the gold standard. If I am planning to introduce an elf into the action, I do not first begin by writing an entire dictionary of the elvish language. So one tries to keep things orderly, which is something that C.S. Lewis really didn't. He was an amazingly sloppy world builder, much as I love him. One tries to keep things very orderly. It's one of the characteristics, I think, of the fantasy that's being written right now, that it tends to try to impose logic and order on these realms of the imagination.
What's the importance when you build the characters that you do and write the kind of stories you do, which depend so much on the interior dialogue, the kind of what's going on in their mind and how they're evaluating their world? Their world plays a much bigger part. So what's the relationship of these characters to Fillory? It's not just the place where they practice their magic.
Well, no, it's a very interesting thing, isn't it? Fantasy was born as a genre, or modern fantasy anyway, in the early parts of the 20th century. In the same moments that modernism, you know, these great writers of the interior life, Joyce and Wolfe and Kafka and Faulkner, it all happened at the same time. And it's interesting to watch them, the way they sort of diverge. The modernists would sort of explore the interior realms of consciousness, and the fantasists like Tolkien and Lewis, T.H. White, Hope Merlis, would kind of project psychology out into the landscape around the characters. And one of the things I sort of think of myself as doing in The Magicians and The Magician King is seeing what happens if you do both at once, try to give characters this kind of rich interior life and then also place them in this fantastical landscape, which is in some case, is in some way a projection or a playing out of their internal psychological conflicts.
And you do it at a time when we are familiar with fantasy. Fantasy now has a history. It has a genealogy of its own. And so I'm wondering what you do if you want to put a dragon in your book, which you have done, whether they have to follow convention. And sure enough, you don't. You have dragons that actually buy buttons at $250 million a pop. So do you feel you can do this? You can actually take liberties with a very conventional stock character, the dragon.
Well, you can't tell a dragon what to do. If it wants to buy a button, it's going to. This is one of the things that is just so grand and wonderful about writing in fantasy. I feel as though when people try to criticize fantasy, they say, well, you know, there's all these conventions, there's all these rules, and it constrains you. Whereas in literary fiction, you can do whatever you want. One of the magnificent things about fantasy is that it does have rules. And when you're writing and there are rules, you then can break the rules, which is just one of the funnest things a novelist can do. And really, if you're not breaking rules when you're writing, I don't know what you are doing. So there's this wonderful way you can sort of scandalize the reader. And also, incidentally, the characters. Quentin himself has read plenty of fantasy novels. He knows what he's supposed to expect from a dragon, and when it doesn't behave the way he expects, he himself is flummoxed.
Yeah, and they've read Harry Potter. They've got the whole all of that down, and parody some of that along the way. Quentin is a very complex character and not always likable. Did he start out being that way for you, or did he become that?
I wanted Quentin to be real. I wanted him to feel psychologically authentic. I didn't want a Peter Pevensey. No offense to Peter Pevensey, who's a wonderful character, but slightly idealized. I didn't want Quentin to be idealized. I wanted him to seem like a real person, and then to show what happened when a real person gets put into these situations, like going to a school for magic or going to a secret magical land. What would happen to a real person? What would they do there, and what would those experiences do to them?
The sequel includes more of another character named Julia. She was Quentin's childhood crush. Now she brings a much darker element to this story. Tell us about her and her development.
Well, Julia is privately my favorite part of The Magician King. Julia was a minor character in The Magicians. She was Quentin's high school chum on whom he had a crush. He got to go to Breakbills, the school for magic, but she didn't. She didn't get into the school. This knowledge that there was a school for magic out there, and there was magic, there was a secret magical world sort of all around her, but that she was shut out of, that she could not access, that knowledge just obsesses Julia, and it kind of destroys her life. And what she has to do is find a way to learn magic and to become herself a magician, but not within the safe sort of ivory walls of a school for magic, but outside on the streets with no, as it were, adult supervision.
Do you think this the genre of fantasy is actually evolving? I mean, you talked about Tolkien being the gold standard. Is it something that everybody aspires to? Does it move on? Or is it a genre where people want those stories told roughly the same way? That's why I'm reading fantasy.
I think there was a time when fantasy felt somewhat static, but if it ever was, it isn't right now. We are going through, I think, you know, this kind of second golden age of fantasy writing, where the genre is evolving and expanding at a furious rate. Just to take the example of George R. R. Martin, for example, who's right now in this just really brilliant, aggressive, strange way reinterpreting the legacy of Tolkien for our sort of more jaded and profane and morally ambivalent age. It's just fascinating what he does, working within the genre, but doing things with it that we never knew were possible.
And of course, that has become an HBO series, his Game of Thrones, so it's received some larger popular audience, one would assume. Now, you are a book critic, so you spend your life liking or not liking other people's books. And then you write a couple yourself, and out come the columns. Do you find it difficult to read them?
Well, it's harder, really, than you would think, or that I had expected, to balance the two roles of being a critic and being a writer. There seems to be some unwritten rule in the world of letters that one is expected to play for, you know, one team or the other. And when you sort of switch uniforms from critic to novelist and then back again, people do sort of look askance at it. I don't know that I blame them necessarily. I often encounter other writers, you know, when I have my writer hat on, and I can see them thinking, you know, what entitles this guy to judge our books when he's just a writer himself? And I don't have a good answer for that.
But have you read negative criticisms of your book, and is that hard?
Oh, it is difficult. It's very difficult. You would think that I, as someone who is accustomed to seeing the critical sausages made, as it were, wouldn't take it too seriously. But I, when it comes to reading negative reviews of my own work, I'm a big baby about it, and it really gets under my skin.
Well, luckily, they're mostly good, so you don't have to worry too much. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Lev Grossman is a book critic for Time magazine, author of The Magicians, and his recently released sequel, The Magician King, going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight at 7 o'clock. And for more information, you can go to levgrossman.com. That's the state of things for today. Our website is stateofthings.org. You can follow us on Facebook. And our program is produced by Amber Nimix, Alex Granados, Isaac Davey Aronson. Ginny Mueller's our intern. Robin Copley's the technical director. Al Wadarski's sitting in today. Managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.